Morning. Let me say once again, it is a great honor and privilege to be here with you. I always appreciate the elders here and the congregation, Brother Tommy and his good wife Sue, and the invitation to be with y'all to be able to speak to you. I always feel humbled, though, that I come here. I always feel unworthy, but I'm very thankful that y'all invite me. And appreciate so much the work you're doing. The work you're doing has a great impact on the brotherhood all over. And so we're very thankful for all the good things that y'all do. And I've enjoyed this week. You know, when I come here, I feel like y'all make me feel like I'm at home. So each time I come, I feel like I'm coming home. So that, that's a special blessing. To matter where you go at and you come someplace that you're not at home, but yet you feel at home. So y'all are very good at making us feel that way. Even though I think you're all a little nuts, but... Especially the elders. Well, one in particular. No, I'm just kidding. But it was a great lesson a while ago, wasn't it? Amen. Brother Michael does a good job. I appreciate him very much. He's a great young man. I appreciate the work he does. My topic today is 666 and the man of sin. Someone said, John, what does 666 mean? I said, well, I don't know, but if you turn it upside down, it's 999. What's that mean? That's just one short of 1,000, right? What does that mean? Now, we're going to look at it this morning and see if we can't come to and understand what the Bible teaches. Actually, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1 through 12, and Revelation chapter 13, verse 11 through 18, have been listed by many scholars as being some of the more difficult passages in the New Testament to understand. But I did find it interesting, though, that what I read after Albert Barnes said that 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 through 12 to him was one of the easier passages, you understand. And, you know, if you will actually study the Bible instead of studying what other people say about the Bible, you might come to some same conclusion that Mr. Barnes did. Not Brother Barnes, but Mr. Barnes. A lack of understanding of these verses has caused and will continue to cause much confusion about the coming of the Lord and things related to that event. The premillennialist folks have taken these verses, along with many others, and have done untold damage to the cause of Christ and will continue to do so because they misunderstand and misapply these verses. Historically, most Protestants, theologians of past generations, assume that the Pope of Rome was the Antichrist, and they connect the Antichrist both to 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, or chapter 2 rather, and also to Revelation 13, and try to make that connection there, but really it's not connected. In fact, Martin Luther declared on August the 18th in 1520, he says, "We are of the conviction that the papacy is the seat of the true and real Antichrist." And so that goes a long, long ways back. This morning, what I want to do, though, I want to take, first of all, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, 1 through 12, and look at the man of sin, and then we'll look at the man of 666. Paul's reason, and I think is important, anytime you're going to study a text, you need to understand the reason for writing the letter that was written that the text falls within. And Paul's reason for writing the letter to the Thessalonians, F.F. Bruce wrote this, which I think he was very accurate on. He said, "If any section can claim to be described as the body of this of the letter, it is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1 through 12. This is not only the most distinctive feature of 2 Thessalonians, it probably represents the purpose of the letter. What precedes leads up to it, and what follows leads on from it." Well, the reason for writing to the church of Thessalonica was because of the lack of understanding about the second coming of the Lord. Paul had already discussed or already addressed this issue in the first letter, and it was seen that either they did not completely understand, or someone had written something which contradicted what Paul had written. In chapter 2, verses 1, 2 and verses 3, Paul makes reference to the gathering together with him, that is, gathering together with Jesus Christ, to the day of Christ is at hand, and to the day shall not come. And all these phrases are references to the second coming of the Lord, or to the end of time, when Jesus would be revealed in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 8. We must always remember that Paul is addressing those things which he had already written about in his first letter. So when Paul speaks of the gathering together unto him, or the day of Christ, etc., he is speaking of the same event which he wrote about in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17, and that is simply the second coming of the Lord. He is not speaking about some modern-day rapture that some would have us to believe. The doctrine rapture, as known today, is without any biblical proof whatsoever. However, many have taken what Paul has written here and applied it to the so-called rapture. In verse 2, Paul makes an appeal to the brethren to be soon not shaken in mind or be troubled. Paul wants them to remain on course, to be steadfast. He wants them to remain firm, you see, in the gospel of Jesus Christ and not to be shaken by anything that might come along. In the latter part of verse 2, Paul states that he does not want them to be troubled either by a spirit or, he says, by a word or by a letter from us. It would seem that someone had come in and had troubled them. However, we're not told who it was, but someone had come in there and had troubled them. Kind of reminds us, I think, of what Paul wrote in Galatians chapter 1, verse 6 through 9, where Paul said, "I marvel that you are so soon removed from the gospel, where you have called the grace of Christ, unto another gospel," he says, "which is not another, but there be some that trouble you, and listen, would pervert the gospel of Christ. But," he says, "though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than which have been preached unto you, let him be accursed." Paul said even there some had come in there in that group and it troubled them. And he says, "if anyone comes unto you preaching any other gospel than what we preached, let him be accursed." And I think Paul is doing the same thing right here. Paul is simply telling them, don't be troubled by what others are saying. Remember what I wrote and remember what I'm saying right now. It would seem as if some had come in trouble with them. In verse 3, Paul says, "Let no man deceive you by any means." And Paul has already stated that there are at least three ways in which they might be deceived. One is by the Spirit, and one is by the Word, and then one is by a letter as from us. And I take this latter part here to think the idea that someone had written a letter to them, a forgery, signing their name, thinking it was from them, and they were reading it as if it were a letter from Paul or perhaps another apostle. But not only does it include these three ways, but really, by any means, someone might deceive them, they are to avoid them at all cost. Deception is always possible, is it not? And therefore, we must always be on guard so as not to be deceived by anyone. Even today, you and I need to always be on guard so that we're not deceived by anyone out there in this world. There are those today, both within the church and without the church, that are trying to deceive us and draw people away after them. And you and I must always be on guard to not allow that to take place and realize that we must have a thus saith the Lord for all that we do. Paul wrote this here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9. He says, "Even him," listen, "whose coming is at the working of Satan." Now listen to this. "With all power and signs and lying wonders." By the way, that lying wonders there, the word lying there, actually goes back and covers all these concepts. Powers that are deceitful, signs that are deceitful, and wonders that are deceitful. They are all lies, based upon lies. Jesus said in Matthew 24, 4 through 5, "Take heed, let no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am a Christ, and shall deceive many." Before the Lord returns, there will be a fallen way, and the second the man of sin, that is the son of perdition, shall be revealed. So before the Lord comes back, there's going to be a fallen way. The man of sin is going to be revealed, according to 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3. Now, those who hold to the premillennialist doctrine want us to believe that the rebellion is political in nature, that it will be worldwide, and this event will take place right before the end of time. But I want you to look carefully at the context of 2 Thessalonians, and if you do, you'll find out that Paul does not speak of a rebellion of that nature. Matter of fact, nowhere in that context is this rebellion being political, nor is it worldwide. Paul simply is talking about the idea that here is going to be a rebellion, but not that it's going to be political or worldwide. That's what he says in, Jesus said rather, in John 18:36-37. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now is my kingdom not from hence." The Lord's kingdom has always been spiritual in nature. It has never been, nor will it ever be, political. The text simply says that the day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. So there it is, before the Lord comes back the second time, there must first be a falling away. The falling away is speaking about a rebellion, a departure, apostate, you see. And that's what's going to take place. Paul, of course, is not the first person to talk about this. Sometimes when people start reading this, they think, boy, this is unique, isn't it? But there are numerous places throughout the New Testament that talk about a falling away. As a matter of fact, Christ himself said something about the falling away, didn't he? Look at Mark 13, verse 22. And compare that text with 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9. Very similar. Jesus says in Mark 13, verse 22, "For false Christ and false prophets shall arise and show signs and wonders to seduce, if it were possible," he says, "the very elect." You know, I'm reminded when I read this and read what Paul wrote about in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9, of what Paul said to the elders at Ephesus in Acts 20. You can't help but see the similarities. In Acts 20, verse 28, "They're fallen. Paul told the elders at Ephesus, 'Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock of which the Holy Ghost has made you overseers,' he says, 'to feed the church of God which he has purchased with his own blood.'" Now listen to verse 29. "For I know this," he says, "that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in, not sparing the flock. Also," he says, "among your own selves, men shall arise speaking perverse things to draw disciples away after them." He said, "Therefore watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I cease not to warn everyone night and day with tears." Paul said there's going to be men rise up among your own self, elders. Talking to the elders at Ephesus. There'll be men rise up amongst your own self who are going to draw disciples away after them. That's an apostasy. That's a rebellion. That's a falling away. So even there, Paul warns about this to those men of that time, prior to writing this letter to 2 Thessalonians. Well, who is the man of sin? Well, the ideas of who the man of sin are many. And you could give a list, and I don't know how long that list would be, but it would be a rather long list if you list all the concepts, ideas, over the years and centuries of who people thought the man of sin was. It's constantly changing, though. But the two primary ideas of who the man of sin is seems to be the Roman Empire, with Nero being that man of sin. And the other thought is the man of sin is the papacy. From the Reformation to this day, most commentators believe that the papacy is whom Paul is speaking about when he refers to the man of sin. I do not believe that Paul is speaking about the Roman Empire nor Nero as being the man of sin. And the main reason for this is that the man of sin seems to be one who will come up from within the church and fall away, being in rebellion against God. Remember, Paul is warning the brethren about someone who is deceiving them about the second coming of the Lord. In many places in the New Testament, the false teachers are from within the body of Christ. As John wrote in 1 John 4, verse 1, Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they of God. Many false prophets have gone out in the world. David Lipson, I believe, is correct in his evaluation of who the man of sin is. And I want to read what he says because I think it's very important. He says, the scriptures give no clear evidence of what the mystery of iniquity was, save that it was to become the man of sin, the lawless one, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is worshipped, sitteth in the temple of God, set himself forth as God. But he says it is universally agreed that it means an apostasy in the church would take place before the day of the Lord or the judgment of the world which should come. He says that power would arise in the church that would draw away from the law of God, that exalts itself into the place of God. God's place is to make laws for his people. This power would take his authority on itself and change and modify the laws of God. So it's said to sit in the temple of God and to exalt and oppose God as the only ruler and lawgiver and set itself forth as a rival of God. Then he goes on to say, I've been inclined to believe that it applies to a principle rather than the development of that principle. The principle was to claim to make laws for the church of God. To do this is to sit in his seat, to show by his acts that he is God, the lawmaker, that he is above the law or is lawless. If it applies to a principle, the Roman church or the papacy is one development of this principle. But then he goes on to say also, the Greek church is another. The church of England is another. And every church of organization in rebellion, or religion rather, that grows out of man's adding to or taking from or changing the order of God is an outgrowth or development of the same principle. And I believe he's correct. Leon Morris stated, associated with rebellion is a person who is traditionally known as the man of sin. He says the title is so universal use, that it is probably impossible to substitute another. But he says the better manuscripts read the man of lawlessness instead of the man of sin. And I really think that helps us to have a better understanding of who this person is. And that fits, it says, in the words used in verses 7 and 8, whereas tradition written obscures the connecting of the thought. You know, when one compares other verses of the Bible with the same language, one will find some very interesting parallels. Look at the language of Isaiah 14, verses 3, there following. The one who's been spoken about is the king of Babylon, verse 4. In verse 12, he is identified as Lucifer, the son of the morning. The king of Babylon said in his heart that he will ascend in heaven. He says, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will be like the Most High. Isaiah 14, verses 13 and verse 14. The language here is the same as in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Would the king of Babylon literally ascend in heaven? Would he actually exalt his throne above the stars of God? Why, no. These sayings are not to be taken literally. They are figures of speech which describe for us how far the king of Babylon had fallen and how he had set himself up as a god. That he thought he was superior to everyone else. Well, the same language had been used in Paul's letter to the brethren there in Thessalonica. Is the very same concept. When one sits himself or herself above God, there falls a certain. The man of sin or the man of lawlessness is this man. He sits himself above God and all that is good, but he will be destroyed. John wrote in 1 John 3, verse 4, whosoever committeth sin transgresses the law of the law, for sin is a transgression of the law. In John's terms, the man of sin or the man of lawlessness could be said to be anyone who transgresses the law of God. To fail to conform to the law of God is to be lawless. That is what the man of sin will do. He will not conform to the law of God. The man of sin opposes himself
exalt himself above all that's called God or that's worship. So it is God. He sitteth himself in the temple of God, showed himself that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4. The man of sin is, after the work of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9 and 10. The powers, signs, and wonders that the man of sin has are all, as I said earlier, based on lies. They are not real. His powers and signs and wonders are deceptive. They will appear to be real, but they will deceive the righteous if they're not looking out for them. We need to be careful not to be deceived. If one lets himself be deceived by these lying wonders, because he does not have the truth in his heart, God will let him believe the lies that the man of sin unleashes upon the world. I believe the man of sin is not referring to any particular man, but to man in general. That is the man who is lawless. The man who, being led by the spirit of Satan, forsakes the Lord, transgresses the law of God. He is the man of sin. If I were speaking about the man of faith, I would not be referring to any particular man, but to man in general, right? And we would all understand that. I would include all men who are faithful to the God. Likewise, when one speaks of man of sin or the man of lawlessness, he is simply speaking about all those who establish themselves as an authority over the teaching of God. And I think that's pretty simple. And when you break it down to its basic concept, it doesn't get much more simple than that. Just compare those two, the man of faith, the man of sin. We understand that the man of faith is, right? We're speaking about that. It's all people that are faithful to God. Therefore, the man of sin is also all those who are against God, the lawless ones, those who oppose God. Does this mean the Pope is a man of sin? Absolutely. But it also means all those who came out of the Catholic Church during the Reformation movement who still hold to those concepts, they are also the man of sin as well. And anyone who establishes their own brand of religion is the man of sin or the lawless one. He is anyone and everyone who exalts himself above God. We have those right now today in the body of Christ who have exalted themselves above God, who are making laws that God has not made, who are binding things that God has not bound, who are loosing things that God has not loosed, and they are the man of sin. They are the man of lawlessness. They have made themselves their own law, and if you don't conform to their law, then you're not with God. What is that? That is exactly what Paul is talking about in the text here. Those who rise up from within ourselves, who set themselves above everyone else, who put themselves in a position of authority that they don't have, they don't deserve, they don't need, and make laws that God has not made, they are the man of sin. Their end is certain. Paul says that this mystery of iniquity, the lawlessness, doth already work, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 7. Whoever the man of sin is, Paul says he's already working his way toward rebellion. And the word mystery gives us the idea that it's hidden at the present time, but it's working to tempt him to unveil himself. And this helps us to understand that the man of sin is not some futuristic person or world leader who will be revealed just prior to the end of time, but rather someone or something that is at work at that very moment of the writing of this book. Paul reveals that there's a force of some nature holding back the rebellion or the man of sin. And notice these words of Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 6 and verse 7. And now you know that with withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time, for the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way. Now Paul doesn't tell us who this force is, only that he is now in place. And that when this force is taken out of the way, removed, the man of sin or the mystery of lawlessness will be able to run without hindrance from this restraining force. Having read quite a bit on this, I've come away with the conclusion that the most popular idea of the restraining force is that of the Roman Empire. And I don't know why people come away with that conclusion, but it seems that's what many of them have come away with. They believe that due to the persecution that the Jewish nation had, that the Roman Empire was a restraining force. And many believe that as long as the Roman Empire was in place, it restrained other nations from doing great harm to Christianity as a whole. Well, it's true that for a time the Roman Empire made laws which aided Christianity and other religious groups to be able to teach their doctrine as long as they gave honor to the emperor. But if one accepts this view, then it would follow that the man of sin would have to come from the Jewish nation. Some would agree with this, saying the temple, verse 4, is reference to the temple of the Jews. Matter of fact, I read a paper on this, about 100 pages long, of a brother that I have great respect for. I believe he was wrong on this. They would support that the temple here was the temple of Jews, but I said, I haven't seen enough evidence to support that. Matter of fact, the temple in verse 4 is a reference to the place where God sits. At the time of the writing of the place of this book, the place that God sat was in the church. The temple is always, throughout biblical writing, has always been a reference to the place of God, the place where God dwells, the place where God's at. And as you come to the New Testament, it switches from that of old to something else. And throughout the New Testament, the temple always refers to the church. That's the place that God now sits. That's the place that God dwells. And I believe in this text here, when it's talking about the temple here, it's talking about the church. And so therefore, it would follow there that this refraining force was someone within the church. It's not someone outside. I believe the restraining force is simply Paul himself. That's not a very proper theory, but I believe it is a correct theory, or correct idea. He could also be referring to the apostolic age. That is during the time when miracles still existed. And one thing clearly thinks about the idea of someone hindering the man of sin, the man of lawlessness. Who better could be referring to the one who's doing that except the very one who's doing it at the very time? Wasn't that what Paul was doing when he wrote this letter? Absolutely. Paul was restraining through his writing the letter by warning them and asking them or telling them to be on guard, watch out, don't let him enter in to take care of him. Matter of fact, in all of Paul's writings and the other apostles' writings, that's what they're doing. And whenever the apostolic age would end, then that would be done away with, and the man of sin would have full access to do whatever he wanted to do. That restraining force would be gone then. David Lipscomb said, "My judgment is that Paul was speaking of a person who hindered or restrained the development of the man of sin, and he says he would continue to restrain as long as he lived. When he died, he was taken out of the way. Then the mystery of iniquity without hindrance would do his work and develop himself." And he says that he believes Paul was that person. Well, I would agree with that. Now, who is the man whose number is 666? Well, this has been a great mystery to so many. And it is very difficult, to say the least. And so as you turn to the book of Revelation, we find here a very difficult passage within the book as a whole. And as I says, it's hard to understand. But many times when you come to the number 666, people avoid using it, don't they? Have you ever been to the grocery store and someone's in front of you and their items ring up to $6.66? And you watch them scramble around and either put something back or get something else because they don't want to be associated with the number 666, you know? How many times have you gotten discussions with someone of that nature? Well, it's just silly, isn't it? But to them, it's real. They honestly believe that any time the number 666 comes up, that they've got to somehow or another avoid that number and get away from it. Because that's the devil's number, you know. And if you pay the 666, the $6.66 that is, that that makes you associated with the devil somehow or another. Well,
you can get pretty silly about these sayings, but I guess some do. At least in my opinion, that's pretty silly. The 13th chapter of the book of Revelation is a study of the two beasts. The first beast is found in verses 1 through 10. The second beast in verses 11 through 18. And the first beast gets its power from the dragon, according to verse 2. And the dragon is Satan, the old devil, Revelation 12, verse 9. Most all agree to some degree that the first beast symbolizes godless civil power. In the context of John's time, the first beast would be symbolic of the power of Rome. The second beast, that is the earth beast, I believe would symbolize the religious world in general who support that which is godless. And this would include later on the Catholic Church and all other, though, religious organizations that are not the true church. Notice in verse 11 that this beast gives off the image of the lamb, but speaks as a dragon. That is, he is deceitful. He is not what he appears to be. Also, the earth beast, according to verse 12, has the function of causing the earth and them that dwell on the earth to worship the first beast. According to verses 12 through 15, all he does is done with the intent to deceive those who dwell on the earth to worship the image of the beast, and those who would not do so should be killed. Verses 16 through 18, I know we're going through this rather hurriedly, but I need to get through this. But verses 16 through 18 shows that the beast has the authority to administer a mark upon those who worship the first beast. The mark was to be given in order to show that those who bore the mark were to be given free access to all that they needed. They could come and go as they pleased and conduct business as they needed, but those who did not wear the mark were not given such freedom. They would be left open for persecution and things of that nature. And if they didn't give in and worship first beast, they would be struggle with them. And it's the age-old struggle of good and evil, isn't it? Good versus evil and evil versus good. The mark of the beast. What was the mark of the beast? Throughout the ages, men have called the mark many different things. Even today, some would say the mark has to do with one's social security number. How many times have you been told that your social security number is the mark of the beast? You know, well, I've been told that a lot. Some would say your bank account is the mark of the beast. Well, if that's true, mine's not much, so don't worry about it. But even now today, you know, the internet going on, they say there's a code on the internet for everyone, and that is the mark of the beast. Well, I haven't seen my code, so I don't know if it's the mark of the beast or not. But these are all just fanciful ideas to try to distract our mind from what really is the mark of the beast. The mark of the beast is not to be taken literal. I believe the mark is simply figurative expression. Just as God knows who belongs to him, so Satan also knows who belongs to him and who does not. You know, Satan works day and night trying to deceive the elect. Therefore, he says, we must know who they are. He would not need to go to place and place a mark on his own in order to know them, would he? When Job went before God and asked about, Satan went before God and asked about Job, did Satan know that Job did not belong to him? Well, certainly he did, didn't he? He knew where Job stood. That's why he went before God to tempt Job, because he knew Job wasn't his. Satan knows who belongs to him, and he knows who doesn't belong to him. Those who are true Christians would never give in to any worship that was not authorized by God, and they would not give in to Satan, therefore they would not wear the mark of the beast. James wrote these words. He says, who is a wise man and doeth with knowledge among you? Let him show of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom, James 3 and verse 13. Just as God places the seal upon the forehead of those who are his, Revelation 7, verse 2 through 4, so does the beast place his seal upon all those who belong to him. God knows who belongs to him, does he not? Does God place a seal upon his children? Absolutely does. Can you see it? Is there something on my forehead that says that I am sealed by God? No. Not literally, is there? So it is with the mark of the beast. It's not a literal marking. Well, my time is rapidly coming to an end.
Let me just take one skip over here. The man whose number is 666. As throughout the ages, they've come up with all kinds of explanations as to who the man of 666 is. And he's been called the papacy, the Nero, the Antichrist, of things of that nature. He's been called just every name you want to name up. Hitler, he was classified that. George Bush has been put in that category. Don't know why, but that's all liberals want to put him in that category, I guess it is. But I believe the number is simply used in a symbolic manner. After all, the rest of the book of Revelation is symbolic. Why should we believe that John changes this verse to anything else? Tommy Self wrote these words. He says, it seems more likely that the 666 is an example of the numerical symbolicism so common in Revelation. Verse 18 says it's a human number, literally the number of a man or a man. If the number 7 is generally agreed to be the numerical symbol for perfection, then 6 falls short of perfection. 3 sixes would represent man's continual failure to meet God's standards, thus the number of man. And he says this, the good news about 666 is not to identify, no identification is necessary. What is important in chapter 13 is not the number's meaning, but its function. It serves to identify the followers of the beast, just as the 144 bear the protective mark of the Lamb. The number needs no interpretation for to us to understand its significance. And simply saying, I really don't have to know what that number means, do I? I mean, if it means one falling short of perfection, which I actually think that's what it means, if it means that or if it means something else, all I need to know is this, that I don't want it and stay away from it, that I need to serve God with all my might and not give in to the wiles of Satan. You know, the scriptures have been quoted often today, this week, that the Satan is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And when I think about a roaring lion, I always think about the idea of this, that when I see a lion stalking his prey, the lion never roars until he has his prey. And that's where Satan is. Satan is deceitful. Satan goes about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, being deceptive. And if we allow him to, he'll deceive us and take us into his dominion. Don't let that happen. Thank you very much.